This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect our office's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in these three fields, all in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on the current trends and issues facing the Garden State. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
My name is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I'd like to welcome you to the May intelligence webinar that we have. We have a very interesting discussion for you today. What I would like to do is introduce our two speakers today. First is Philip C. Bleek. He is the assistant professor in the Graduate School of International Policy and Management and a fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Both of those are at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, California. His research and teaching focuses on the causes, consequences, and amelioration of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapon proliferation to states and non-state actors. We're also joined by Zach Kallenborn. He's a senior associate analyst at ANSWER, a not-for-profit government consultancy. At ANSWER, he conducts future analysis, organizational strategy assessments, and systems thinking analysis for offices within the Department of State, Commerce, and Homeland Security. I happened to see Philip a couple months ago at the International Studies Conference where he gave a version of this briefing, and I thought it would be fascinating for you all to see, very thought-provoking and worthwhile to hear and think about as we move forward. So with no further ado, gentlemen, I'm going to hand it off to you.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Dean. Philip Blake here. So thanks very much to both Dean and to the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security for this opportunity to engage all of you. And I was really impressed by the way in which Dean engaged at the International Relations Conference that he mentioned, where we crossed paths. So quick disclaimer right up front. So this presentation and the paper that's associated with it represents our personal views. And so it doesn't represent the policies or positions of any of our current or past employers. That done, let's dive right in. I just want to kind of briefly engage on a question that some of you may have, though those who had it more strongly might have chosen not to tune in at all, which is why assess eco-radical CBRN threats? It seems awfully nichey, perhaps, to some of you. And the reason that we undertook this research project and produced this paper is that although CBRN terrorism threats broadly are widely feared, they are empirically quite rare, and I think logically that makes sense that we don't see CBRN terrorism all that often, though we'll talk about some of the exceptions to that. So the CBRN terrorism threat really hinges on trying to identify outliers, people who combine the motivations and some degree of capability to be able to both want to and to be able to carry out CBRN terrorism threats. And one of the things that I've been struck by over the years working the broader CBRN terrorism issue, both in the DC think tank community and academic community, and then for a little while in government as well. I served in the Pentagon, and this was part of my portfolio there. One of the things I've been struck by is that in sort of red teaming or brainstorming sessions about this CBRN terrorism threat broadly, eco-radicals often came up as potential outliers, as individuals who might combine both motivation and potentially capability. And despite the fact that they came up a lot, there's very little literature specifically focusing on eco-radical CBRN threats. So talk a little bit about what's out there during our presentation. But basically, there's some broader studies of eco-radical threats that briefly touch on the CBRN issue, but there's no dedicated threat assessment. And so Zach and I thought that this was a useful space that we might fill. The genesis of this project actually was Zach was not too long ago a master's candidate at the university where I've been teaching for a couple years, and I teach a dedicated class on CBRN terrorism, and he wrote a short memo that I really liked, and that was the kind of initial starting point for this broader project. So before we dive in, let me give you a little bit of a roadmap. So I'll give you in a second kind of a quick bottom line up front. This isn't a mystery novel, so we're not going to save the good stuff for the end, though we will then obviously flesh out what I've offered you briefly up front. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about how we think about this as an analytic problem and also making some generalizations about how we think about the eco-radical milieu as it relates to the way we think about the CBRN terrorism threat more broadly. And then Zach, I'll turn it over to Zach, and he'll talk a little bit about the specific currents that we divide the eco-radical milieu up into. And then so he'll disaggregate a little bit the different actors within the milieu because they have rather different motivations and somewhat different capabilities as well. And then he'll sum it up as well with some conclusions and some what we think are some worrying trends. So what's the bottom line up front? The vast majority of even people we would label eco-radicals fundamentally embrace nonviolence. So, for example, when they engage in arson attacks, for example, like the famous attack on the Vail ski resort, they fret a lot about even the loss of life of the bugs and the mice and the other living creatures that might be affected by those actions. So for the vast majority of eco-radicals, violence as a whole, and certainly CBRN violence, is not something that even sort of enters the kind of radar screen. There are fringe elements, however, within the milieu who unequivocally embrace violence, including CBRN modes of violence, and we'll talk a little more about those specifically. And there's some worrying trends, both in terms of what individuals and groups have historically articulated, and also if one tries to infer motivations to different actors, I think there's some reason for concern. Capabilities, as you might expect, are generally quite low. But we think, and we'll make the case to you, that there's the potential for significant outliers, and also that there are some decreasing technological thresholds in this domain over time, though one wouldn't want to exaggerate the impact of those in the near term, and that's something we can talk about too. So we expect that eco-radicals will continue to engage in lower level, especially chemical and biological attacks of the sort that we've seen in the past. And we think that if more serious CBRN terrorism occurs in the coming years, eco-radicals are one milieu out of which that might emerge. They're not the only milieu, and I think we're comfortable talking about how we think about the CBRN terrorism threat more broadly at the end also. So diving into how we think about analyzing this problem, so like many other analysts, we disaggregate motivations and capabilities, so we think it's useful to talk about them separately. We do want to acknowledge, though, that they're somewhat linked. So having motivations obviously might lead actors to go out and seek capabilities, but conversely, actually having capabilities might also drive actors to be more motivated. So there's obviously a kind of a circular or connected relationship there, but we still think that analytically it's useful to disaggregate these. So I'm going to generalize a little bit about how we think about capabilities broadly and how we think about them with regard to the eco-radical milieu, and then I'll do the same for motivation. So in terms of capabilities, we're sort of interested in various things to include materiel, sort of material things, both inputs and technology, information and the skills to employ that information and use those technologies. And the one that we think gets a little bit of short shrift often in threat assessments is logistics. And we think that relates nicely to trying to assess CBRN terrorism threats broadly. Generalizing about the eco-radical milieu, we think that capabilities are mostly very low. So the attacks that we've seen historically have been quite crude, and Zach will talk about, I think, in his remarks, some of the specific examples that we've seen. The eco-radical milieu tends to be characterized by a sort of a leadership resistance structure. And what that means is that there is less logistical capability to carry out a more sophisticated CBRN attack, but it also means that from the perspective of law enforcement, it's harder to track and interdict the activities of some of these groups and individuals. And then we think within that milieu that there is some potential for more capable individuals and groups. As a whole, eco-radicalism tends to attract somewhat more educated, better resourced individuals. So we think that there is some potential for people who bring more to the table in terms of capabilities, even if we think on average, a level of capability is quite low. In terms of motivations, we think about strategic, broad motivations. We think about tactical motivations, particular, narrow, or specific objectives that groups and individuals might be seeking to accomplish. And we also think that ideological motivations are really important. So a motivation to carry out certain kinds of attacks, not because of some cost-benefit calculus, but because of the character of those attacks. We think that's particularly important, I think, in the eco-radical case. For most terrorists, not just eco-radicals, there are really strong motivations to avoid CBRN, which is counterproductive for many, fundamentally antithetical to a lot of things that they hold ideologically dear, but we don't think that's true for everyone. For eco-radicals, as I mentioned, CBRN seems counterproductive to their goals for most, and there is this really strong norm of nonviolence, which makes it less likely that actors would be motivated in this direction and potentially constrains those actors if they're operating in broader milieus that might try to dissuade them or report them or otherwise constrain them. There is, though, among a very small slice of the eco-radical milieu, more significant rhetorical support for violence. It's mostly rhetorical, but there's some interesting past exceptions to that. In particular, there's a kind of a pretty virulent strain of eco-radicalism that views human beings as a sort of a cancer on the earth. And I think you can see sort of logically that if you view humans that way, and if part of your goal is to reduce this sort of excessive human impact on the earth, that certain kinds of large-scale attack, if they were feasible, and that's a really important caveat, and we'll unpack that more, might be desirable. And we also think that it's quite plausible that in the face of worsening environmental conditions and increased public attention to those worsening environmental conditions, particularly around global warming or climate change, but potentially around other issues as well, that those might motivate some groups and individuals to more radical action than they have engaged in the past. So generalizing about the specific sub-elements of CBRN, so the chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear modes, so we think chemical attack is the most likely, in particular, low-level attacks. This describes the vast majority of past eco-radical attempts, and we think such attacks are likely to have quite modest consequences, perhaps no direct consequences at all in human beings, in many cases, and in other cases, somewhat modest consequences, albeit some broader psychological impact. Biological is probably the second most plausible category. It describes some of the past more significant attempts, some of the outliers that we've seen in the past. I think the motivations are pretty intuitive. You can imagine eco-radicals seeing themselves as a kind of a vector through which Mother Earth is, you know, asserting herself in response to the insults being inflicted on her. So bio and its sort of natural dynamic is something that I think is potentially quite appealing to eco-radicals, though this hinges on capabilities. We say often that we're more worried about biologists becoming terrorists than we are terrorists becoming biologists. In other words, people who already have deep knowledge, perhaps already situated, working in laboratories, say postdocs, people who have deep knowledge and perhaps have access to infrastructure that they can use, are who we then become radicalized, are who we worry about more rather than people who have relatively little capability and go out to seek it. We think radiological is pretty unlikely. There's actually a pretty good sort of tactical or functional argument for radiological. It's great for area denial and to impose a costly cleanup and psychological effect without injuring a lot of human beings, right? So if you wanted to force someone to shut down a slaughterhouse or a particular facility, contaminating it with radioactive material so that it was just over the health thresholds that would be considered acceptable would be an effective way to do that if you were able to do that. And there's some logistical challenges associated with accessing and disseminating radiological material. But we think ideologically for most eco-radicals, this is going to be a really unappealing attack mode. This is something they're going to regard as unnatural and man-made in a way that's quite inconsistent with their broader ideologies. Nuclear is in there because nuclear is in the CBRN acronym, and we debated at times whether it belonged in the paper at all. We think nuclear fission terrorism attack by eco-radicals is extremely unlikely. We don't think it's unimaginable. And I think if you think about motivations, nuclear is quite consistent with some of the maximalist motivations that we see at the really, really extreme fringes of the eco-radical movement. Thankfully, we think it's wildly unlikely that individuals with those motivations in that milieu would have those capabilities. Having said that, there's a broad debate about whether and how serious the nuclear fission terrorism threat is, and to the extent that one thinks it's a serious threat. And many people, many serious people certainly do, the eco-radical milieu is one milieu out of which one could at least imagine something like this emerging. But I guess we lose a little less sleep about this one than we do about some of the others, particularly, I think if you told me there was a sophisticated CBRN eco-radical attack, I think bio is probably what I would expect it would have been. And then finally, I just want to flag, and this is something we can also unpack a little bit, that there are both some recent, but really some ongoing and future trends in terms of technological innovation. So things like the potential for genetic manipulation through CRISPR, for example, chip scale chemistry through microfluidics, 3D printing that are changing this landscape probably less today. And I think often the kind of near-term consequences of this are a little bit exaggerated, but certainly in the long run, this is a kind of a brave new world that we're entering. And so it may dramatically change the capabilities that are available to non-state actors. And so that's something we want to at least flag. So I'm going to turn it over to Zach now, and he'll talk about both the kind of three broad currents that we divide the eco-radical milieu, which is composed of lots of different individuals and groups, up into, and then also the kinds of categories of potential attacks that we then map onto those currents and that we try to use to disaggregate the motivations and capabilities, but especially the motivations that might be out there.
Yeah. Thanks, Philip, and thanks again, Dean, for inviting us to share our research today. So as Philip was saying, for this half, I want to break down the different subsections that comprise this milieu. Now, we based our analysis around Ron Taylor's topology that looked at general radical environmentalism, green anarchism, and radical animal rights. Now, I'll describe those in more detail as we go on, but the basic idea is that each of these have different individuals, organizations, and ideologies that are going to then shape their actual behavior in relation to CVRN. Now, in the paper, we looked at it with each of these currents with respect to four overarching potential types of attack based on their scale. So at the smallest end, you have non-human, where you're not actually attempting to kill anyone, but you might be, for example, trying to cause additional damage to a potential target. At low level, you're looking at casualties in the range of about 0 to 10. Large scale, tens to hundreds, and catastrophic is over 1,000. Now, as it would be a bit repetitive to go through each of these for each of the currents, I'm just going to, today, just going to be giving sort of the highlights. But the basic idea is that, the motivations that are going to push someone to kill a single individual or just kind of harm them a little bit are very different than the motivations that would cause someone to cause upwards, thousands of casualties. An important caveat is in order here. I think for many organizations, they may very much struggle to actually achieve that level of capability. They may think in that they can cause huge amounts of casualties, but in practice, they may not be able to achieve that for whatever reason. And alternatively, in some cases, you may even have the opposite, where they actually inflict more casualties than were intended. So for example, with genetic engineering, if they're working with some new bacteria trying to induce some new gain-of-functional research on it, they may, for example, accidentally add some level of capability that they weren't actually expecting. And especially the case, since it's not like they can do a peer-review analysis on their weapon. So while that is possible, we think it's, for the most part, we don't consider those type of accidents. So the first main current is general radical environmentalism. This comprises sort of the majority of the radical environmental groups. For them, their main goal is to alter the cost-benefit calculus of environmental exploiters. So basically, they undertake attacks to increase the costs of organizations that are exploiting the environment. Because ideally, if you increase the cost, you're going to remove the profit incentive. That's what drives their behavior, and therefore you'll change the behavior. So within this current, the two main organizations are Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front, or ELF. Earth First emerged in 1972 out of more traditional environmental movements, believing that protesting and traditional action really is not enough, that you really need to confront and more aggressively attack the exploiters. So they pioneered the tactic of tree spiking, which is where you take large metal spike and hammer it into a tree. The idea being that when the tree is cut down and it moves through the logging equipment, the metal spike will hit the saws and break the equipment. Alternatively, it may cause some small level of casualty if there's like shrapnel shooting off or that sort of thing. Now, ELF came out of Earth First in the early 1990s, believing that Earth First, too, did not actually go far enough. So ELF pioneered the tactics, I don't know if pioneer is the right word, but they utilized the tactics of arson specifically. So they were responsible, as Philip mentioned, for the burning down of the Vail, Colorado ski resort, which cost, I think, about $14 million worth of damage. Now, as a whole, their actions tend to be primarily very unsophisticated. For tree spiking, you only need a large metal spike and a hammer and not really much more than that. They also tend to be nonviolent. Now, as I mentioned, there is some risk, of course, of having human casualties, but they take explicit steps to try and mitigate this as much as possible. So when Earth First spikes trees, they put up warning signs all over saying these trees are spiked, don't cut them down. Because ultimately, their goal is to prevent the logging companies from destroying these trees and making money off of it rather than actually inflicting harm. So if we think about general radical environmentalism and CVRN, we think pretty much most forms of CVRN attack are going to be pretty unlikely, except maybe non-human attacks where you don't actually aren't going to harm anyone. So this current has no history at all of CVRN usage, and we think that any CVRN usage would really be contrary to their conventional behavior. So there was an interesting book that was put out about strategies for radical environmentalism geared towards radical environmentalists. And it specifically emphasized that their attack should be as simple as possible, their attack should be controlled, and their attack should not harm any human life. And that's pretty much the antithesis of basically every form of CVRN possible. And we also see generally within this current that really there aren't any examples of violence. So the notion that they would even small levels of CVRN attack is sort of hard to imagine. Now, that changes a bit when we move to green anarchism. Now, green anarchism blends elements of environmentalism with more traditional anarchy, and their goal is to dismantle the industrial system. Now, when they refer to industrial system, I think a good way to understand what they're talking about is through the really common example of a refrigerator, where probably every single person who's listening today has a refrigerator, but the ability to have and to acquire a refrigerator entails a massive complex system to make it work. So at a basic level, you need to assemble all the different pieces of the refrigerator. You have the hinges that make the door work. You also have the various hard plastics and the little insulation that makes sure it's actually shut. And each of those parts have to be manufactured somewhere. So you need some big industrial machine that's making these on a mass scale. Then you also need the machines and industry to actually put all of those parts together. And then you need another system of infrastructure to actually bring that refrigerator to your house. Then, of course, you also have the complex power system, which is going to be comprised of a wide variety of types of power plants that then need to bring energy to your house. So even something as simple as a refrigerator is very complex. And that they believe that that complexity is inherently exploitive of the environment because we need to develop and acquire all sorts of resources and create potential environmental problems in order to make that happen. And their belief is that we need to dismantle all of that because and return to more of a hunter-gatherer state. So organizations within this current have been relatively rare, and they've typically been small. So probably the most significant example for our analysis is RISE, which was made up of a couple of community college students, and they recruited about a few followers in 1972, and they sought to poison Chicago's water supply. The idea was to basically kill off humanity and repopulate the earth with more enlightened revolutionaries who would recognize the value of the environment. The Unabomber also had strong green anarchist tendencies. So Ted Kaczynski, his actual name, undertook a bombing campaign for a few decades in the 70s, 80s or so, for much the same reason, where he wanted to bring down the industrial systems. He felt it was deeply intrusive, and he also felt that it robbed him of fundamental humanities, because in order for the system to exist, you necessarily have to constrain behavior to specific things that support the existence of that system. There's also individualities tending towards savagery, which is a more recent one that's targeted folks in scientists in the nanotech industry. They have undertaken small bombing campaigns, but it looks like it's comprised of probably only a small cell just because their actions are relatively infrequent, like on the scale of every year or two. And more recently, there's deep green resistance, which appears to have a lot broader support as it spread to about 8 or so different countries. It also emphasized a green anarchist ideology, but also blends some interesting elements of social justice in with it. Now, these organizations as a whole have been typically very violent. Every single one of these has either engaged in or explicitly supports violence. So the first three, RISE, Unabomber, and ITTS, they all actively attacked individuals. Deep green resistance rhetorically supports violence as a part of their broader strategy, but it's not clear quite yet they actually have engaged in violence. That may be partially because they've only been around for a few years. So when it comes to CBRN, for green anarchism, we believe basically all scales are possible. Because the goal is to destroy the system, and that would require a significant amount of action. Oh, I'm just going to respond briefly to the question here, because I think that's connected to what I was just saying. So are we seeing an increase in the number of members of these groups? So with the Deep Green Resistance, I think so, as that's a relatively new organization that's been expanding relatively rapidly. To what extent their actual membership is unclear. Just going off of Facebook likes, which isn't a great heuristic, but kind of gives us a vague sense that's in the neighborhood of few thousand anyway, but you know, who knows if those are actually supporters or people who are just vaguely interested. I follow them on Facebook. So looking again at green anarchism and CBRN, we think basically all forms are going to be possible. So since they are very much interested in destroying the entire system, that's going to inherently require pretty significant action, including potentially catastrophic level activities. And these organizations are often violent. As we see from the past examples, basically all of them have engaged in violence. Now, the big concern is if capabilities and motivations align, serious consequences may be possible. I think the motivations are clearly there, but because they've been so infrequent, even though the total number of groups is a little bit higher in terms of timeline, they don't actually happen that often. So I think the capabilities there is going to be a little bit of a problem. And if those two come up together, that could be potentially quite problematic. So the third trend is the animal rights organizations. Now, they are a bit different than the others in that they narrowly focus on animal abuse and exploitation. So to understand animal rights, I think it's important to contrast them to animal welfare, which is what most of us think about when we think about, you know, helping animals and that sort of thing. So animal welfare believes that it's okay to use and exploit animals, provided that we do so in a way that is humane and relatively okay. So we don't want to see examples of chimpanzees being hit over the head with baseball bats. But if we treat them nicely, it's not really that big of a deal if we use them for science or we potentially use them as food. For animal rights activists, they believe even that's not okay, because they believe that all animals have an inherent right to life, basically equivalent to human life. So what that means that factory farms and various activities that happen all the time is incredibly abhorrent. Factory farms, for example, in their view, is equivalent to an ongoing Holocaust. And they even explicitly make that comparison to the Holocaust, because every day you had thousands, tens of thousands of animals being killed. And in their view, because it's equivalent to killing humans, that's equivalent to tens of thousands of humans being killed every day for our pleasure or our just general consumption. So organizationally, there's a bit of a broader variety of these. So Animal Liberation Front is the main one. They also organize themselves as a legalist resistance. You basically self-select into the movement, and I can undertake an action and go online and post it to, they actually have message boards, and I can say, hey, this is the action that I took. Here's a picture of some graffiti I sprayed on this butcher shop, for example. Then there's a couple other animal rights militia and Justice Department of UCLA that both stemmed out of Animal Liberation Front, and they take a little bit more violent action. They both undertook some brief bombing campaigns, and Justice Department also sent out letters with razor blades with rat poison on them. There's also a few others that have been more targeted specifically rather than looking at animal abuse as a whole. So Stop Hunting to Animal Cruelty has been narrowly focused on Huntington Lab Sciences that does a lot of animal testing. And Negotiation is Over is a relatively recent organization that targets the University of Central Florida for some lab test or for some animal testing that they do there. So their actions, again, have been very much unsophisticated. They do things like they go to fur farms where you have like minks and ferrets and whatnot for use of like fur coats and that sort of thing. And they'll just let them loose and free. And that's a pretty common form of attack. On occasion, you see some acts of violence. Even those are relatively unsophisticated. So the particularly interesting one is Negotiation is Over. One of the things they've been doing is they put up posters around the University of Central Florida offering $100 for any student who would turn over the names of a life science student and who was working in the lab. And then the folks in Negotiations Over would call them and then harass them and threaten them. I want to say they may have like even shown up at like someone's house, but I don't remember that specifically. But basically a variety of intimidation with, you know, very low cost, with very low sophistication. And there have been some more egregious acts of violence. So, as I mentioned, Justice Department or threats thereof. So Justice Department sent out letters with rat poison, for example. Now, when it comes to CBRN, the animal rights groups are responsible for the vast majority of eco-radical CBRN attacks. And they've primarily been non-human or very low level, you know, those sort of threatening behaviors. One of the interesting things you see is that a little bit of a polarization of violence. So for the majority of animal rights organizations, they strongly adhere to nonviolence. And it makes sense. Why? Because fundamentally, they see themselves as preserving life. So if I'm preserving life, it's kind of antithetical to go and kill a whole bunch of people. It doesn't really make all that much sense. And in fact, it's to the point where they are concerned in their arson attacks about potentially harming bugs and that sort of thing. And for the most part, their attacks have been primarily unsophisticated and crude. So as a result of that, it's sort of hard to imagine many of these individuals really engaging in really robust CBRN attacks. So Kay asks, what is the concern that these actors will take their skills over to ideological terrorist groups? So overall, I think it's relatively small. Sort of, as we've mentioned throughout, for the most part, these folks have, across all the currents, they have really low levels of capabilities. So the notion that they would potentially bring their skills over is a little bit hard to imagine. About the only example where you might have that is sort of the example that Philip mentioned earlier about a biologist becoming a terrorist, which has a little bit more potential, but for the most part, we don't necessarily see a specific indication of that. If we look over the presentation as a whole, I think we can draw a few conclusions. So firstly, nonviolence is an incredibly important part of this movement, and that's going to be a significant limiter for most folks in this or within this milieu, but you have seen some robust, expressed, and potential movements among those fringe elements. So as I mentioned, like deep green resistance, some elements that offshoots of the Animal Liberation Front, they have expressed support for the NFNH in more radical actions. And going to the future, we think most attacks are likely going to be hoaxes. So one of the more significant ones is some animal liberation folks. They put out a press release that they had infected a whole bunch, hundreds of Mars bars in the UK with rat poison, and I think it was about 82 or so. It's not clear whether they actually did that or not, but they caused several $1 million worth of recall. And we think that's probably going to be characteristic of what it's going to look like going forward. And occasionally you'll see some actual non-human or low-level attacks, probably using chemical and biological means. But we think there is a small but non-zero possibility of more consequential CBRN. And that's really only likely to occur if you have that marrying of capabilities and motivations, which is by no means certain that that'll actually happen. There are nonetheless a few worrying trends. So firstly, we've seen some increasing rhetorical support for violence within the radical and animal rights movement. So one particular fellow, Gary Uresky, talks a lot about the importance of violence in the animal rights movement. And he's one of the folks who explicitly compares animal rights activism to preventing the Holocaust. And he makes the argument that, well, violence was justified in the case of preventing the genocide in World War II. So it makes sense that it would be morally justified here because it's morally equivalent. And you also see the emergence of some highly motivated green anarchist groups, specifically deep green resistance. And they have the potential for more significant capabilities simply because of their much larger size. And on a higher level, generally, worsening environmental conditions are potentially going to increase the motivations, because especially if you see some of those more apocalyptic predictions about what might happen with climate change. Now, regardless of whether those happen or not, certainly if it looks like it is going in that trend, these folks may see that and see that as evidence that, you know, we're not doing enough here. We really need to do a whole lot more. So overall, we would simply say that for the most part, it's very unlikely that we would see really significant CBRN attacks coming out of this movement, but there is a real possibility.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I have a bunch of questions for you. What I'd like to talk to you guys about first is in the discussion about different sort of levels of attacks, and you talk about the low-level non-human attacks. I'm wondering if you've seen anything with regards to intent to, I don't know how to put this, I guess maybe target humans as a second-order consequence. And what I mean by that is, let's say, target crops so that it will deny sustenance and food to human beings. Or I guess the Vail, Colorado one is one to sort of target people economically. But I'm just wondering if you've seen in terms of sort of food supply, looking to apply CBRN attacks to food supply, if you've seen any indications of that or how they might approach that.
So I'll do a quick start on that and then turn it over to Zach. So broadly, I think that modes of agroterrorism are potentially plausible, with the significant caveat that livestock, for example, which are perceived as living entities, seem much less likely to be attacked. But I could imagine that attacking wheat or other forms of crops that weren't sentient beings might be something that was more readily justified. And one of the things that's striking about agroterrorism is how much more accessible it is than a lot of the other attack modes. So I think that's logically an interesting one to think about, though I think there are a lot of reasons to not expect it. Zach has been really immersing himself in this milieu to the point where I'm mildly fearful about his, I'm mostly joking, but his future clearance reviews. But so I think he'll be in a good position to answer the question of whether he's actually seen people on chat groups or otherwise mulling that kind of attack mode.
So there's been a handful of examples, not specifically employing CBRN and not looking at that sort of second order effect. But you have seen certainly a lot of interest in genetically modified organisms and generally crops. So there has been, I think, 3 attacks in total that have targeted specifically GMO producers and have purely focused on the actual crops. Those weren't using CBRN, but I think it is within the realm that they would especially see that, especially since just broadly concern over genetically modified organisms seems to be growing as a whole. I don't necessarily have a strong basis for that, but at least that's my general impression. And I think that certainly could justify doing so, because they would very much worry about, you know, what are the second order and third order effects less towards in terms of causing damage, but in terms of sort of preventing damage, where you have some sort of genetic change that then filters out to the natural environment and then perhaps induces changes that then could be harmful to humans or to other crops. So to me, I think that's the potential scenario where you would see that. But I think the concern about capabilities is still going to be a big one, since especially with CBRN, even for agroterrorism, you would need a relatively high level of capabilities, perhaps not as high for agro as others, but you would still nonetheless need to acquire like some sort of agent and make it some large capacity or quantity.
So actually, that sparks two thoughts for me. One is, have you seen any discussion about trying to exploit, let's say, existing, I think primarily biological agents? So a couple years ago, we had the avian influenza, which really did a lot of damage to poultry farms in the Midwest. I'm curious to know if you think it's possible or saw any interest in trying to sort of exploit that, whether it's animals or plant-based sort of victims.
Yeah, so I think I'll take that one. So I would say yes, without question, although it's been relatively infrequent. So there was a specific example in, I want to say, the early 90s, but I don't remember exactly when the date was, of some folks in California when there was a big outbreak of med flies. It's not clear whether it was actually natural or induced. I think it was ultimately determined that that was just a natural outbreak. But some folks did claim credibility, they did claim responsibility for that. And I sent in a letter to a local newspaper saying, we are the so-and-so. I don't remember exactly what their name was. But basically, they said, oh, yeah, this was us. That being said, I think that's the only example that I've seen. But certainly it makes sense that that may be have some appeal, because it's sort of, hey, look, there's this natural outbreak, and we could say, oh, this was our fault. See, this is what happens when you start tinkering with nature, for example, or this is the problems that we have resolved or that human beings have caused.
One thing that's really characterized activity in this milieu is hoaxing. And so I think what we are likely to see is people trying to take responsibility for or indirectly use, sort of like the razor blades allegedly infected with HIV, indirectly use diseases that are sort of in the public consciousness, as opposed to someone actually trying to use one, which requires a level of sophistication that we generally don't see. That said, that's certainly one of the things that one could imagine a sort of outlier with more significant capabilities trying to do.
Excellent. And that's great, because that tees up my next question. You had alluded to sort of the democratization of technology, how it's getting more and more accessible to more and more people. And I was wondering if you could talk a little more about that, about how you see that progressing maybe over the next 5 years or so, and what the implications of some of those technological advances might be in this particular topic.
So in terms of broader technological trends, I think there's a few that really come to mind. But in the 5 year timeline, I don't know how much will actually be all that significant. So one of the major concerns is the proliferation of like do-it-yourself technology, which I don't know too much about it, but as I understand it, the basic gist is you can get biological kits there. You can basically play around with some very basic gene editing and with some very basic biological synthesis. This is not my area of expertise, so I apologize if that's, I'm not getting the details right. But as I understand it, basically there is some potential of developing biological capabilities that way. More broadly, to me, I think the largest concern, and I think Philip can hit a few others as well, but to me, the biggest concern is really just the internet and modern communication technology, where there's just so much information that you can find online, where in the past, organizations might rely on just general know-how or try to get like the access to the anarchist cookbook. Now there's just so incredibly much information that you can find about how to make specific stuff. You can also find information about where to buy stuff. So as a part of a different research project that I worked on when I was in graduate school, we looked at the availability of biological weapons equipment online. And so we looked at used laboratory sales places, where basically laboratories that have closed down sold their equipment, and that's where, or just general used equipment. And we could find basically everything that you would want to make a biological weapons capability. And I think even beyond just that sort of access, there's also just the general access of information and being able to find people to potentially talk to. So as a part of that project I mentioned, I called up some folks in Illinois who worked on pesticides, and I asked them some really specific questions that really only applied to biological weapons capabilities. And they gave pretty thorough details, basically telling me exactly what I needed to know and including a few pieces of information that they volunteered that I didn't even have a notion that this could be a pretty significant issue. They just sort of volunteered up, I guess, because I sounded professional and relatively articulate. So to me, those are the big trends, I think, that are potentially making this more plausible.
I think one interesting way to think about this is to think about the Aum Shinrikyo case from the early 1990s. And to think about what it would be like if we had an Aum-like scenario, and Aum is an extraordinary outlier in a whole bunch of ways, but what if we had an Aum today? Would they be more capable, and how might they be capable given the technology that they would have access to today? I had a remarkable experience some years back where I worked on the first ever, to the best of my knowledge, the only study that has ever actually debriefed the Aum Shinrikyo terrorists about their biological weapons program. They were never debriefed by Japanese law enforcement authorities because their biological weapons program, unlike their chemical weapons program, was an abject failure. They didn't actually injure any human beings, and so law enforcement wasn't interested in it. And working with former Secretary of the Navy Richard Danzig, we got access to the cult members, including the ones on death row in Japan, and debriefed them about the program. And it turns out that they were trying to do something. There's a conventional narrative about why they failed with Bissell's anthracis, which is that they got a vaccine strain by mistake. And it turns out, it looks like, and the evidence is suggestive rather than definitive, that they were trying to do something quite sophisticated in terms of turning a more benign strain of Bissell's anthracis into a more virulent strain by transferring a plasmid. And there's a paper that was written at the university where Endo, the PhD virologist who was at the head of their biological weapons program, had studied about how to do this. This was an extraordinarily sophisticated thing, and they abjectly failed at doing it. But what's striking about Aum is that they have this kind of mixture of science and science fiction. So they had a PhD virologist, they had a master's in chemistry, they had a practicing physician. They had extraordinary resources of somewhere between $100 million and $1 billion of U.S. equivalent assets, a lot of that tied up in real estate. But nonetheless, they had a lavishly funded program. One of the things that they struggled with, so they made this wet slurry of Bissell's anthracis, and they pumped it out, and they needed a specialized nozzle to be able to aerosolize it, and it's very expensive, and the waiting period was a couple months to get it from a specialized, I think, German company that produced it. So they decided to make their own, and they made this really crummy nozzle, and it just gooped out the wet slurry, and what they had, what they were trying to pump out, wouldn't have been virulent anyway. But it is interesting, I think, to think about how they, I don't know that today they would have sort of fundamentally different capabilities accessible to them, but increasingly today and going forward, and maybe not within 5 years, but sort of 10, 15, 20, this landscape does start to look radically different. And there are ways in which, for example, one might order up a microfluidics chip that black box some technology so that instead of having to do sophisticated chemical procedures, one might be able to order something up that would produce a particular compound and potentially a very pure version of that compound. There's a lot of ways one can spin sort of Tom Clancy novels out of this, and it's worth taking that with a big grain of salt too. But I think increasingly the concern is going to be, again, biologists becoming radicalized, people with technical expertise who become radicalized, and frankly, eco-radicalism is a milieu that draws people like that. And so you can imagine, you know, Aum had certainly wasn't an eco-radical group, but had aspects of that in its philosophy. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, very much did. And, you know, he was a math professor. Had he been a biology professor, would that threat have looked different? It might have. It's interesting to think about what he might have been capable of doing in his cabin. But I think, you know, in the near term, I take sort of serious threat assessments here with a big grain of salt. But in the long term, I think this is we're in such an extraordinary scientific revolution right now that a lot of things that we take for granted today, we won't be able to take for granted anymore going forward.
Awesome. It's interesting. When we were at the International Studies Association, there was another presentation, and I believe one of the speakers was talking about a growth industry where, particularly in China, there are labs that will sort of manufacture chemicals to your specifications. And while there are a number of chemicals that are sort of on the banned list, like sarin or other sort of clearly identified chemical weapons, at least to this one presenter, it wasn't clear how rigorous they were in looking at it. And so if you just change the chemical formula slightly to still make it deadly, but just sort of not make it on the list, if you could still order those or not.
Just briefly related to that, organized crime who are in the drug space are obviously becoming quite sophisticated chemically in terms of both processing drugs like cocaine or heroin, but also making synthetic drugs. And so that is, I think, a very significant concern, not necessarily narrowly related, obviously, to the eco-radical space.
So when we're talking about these threat actors, do they tend to announce their intent or do they keep that sort of covert? In the past, what have we seen?
So I would say it depends somewhat. So typically a lot of actions, they only announce them when they do various postings online and say, hey, look, here's what we did. You certainly see some more generic type of signaling in terms of, hey, we're interested in doing these sort of types of attack potentially. Deep Green Resistance, for example, pretty strongly indicates that they want to at least support or have people undertake attacks, especially against industry. But in terms of actual like specifics, like I'm going to go attack tomorrow, not that I've seen in terms of that type of thing. In terms of surprise, I don't know to what extent that is really a big concern, in part because their sort of attacks tend to be relatively small. They also often sort of signal in other ways. So, for example, calling people up and harassing them before they actually undertake attacks. So the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, they did quite a lot of harassment and small like car bombs and that sort of thing of folks at Huntington Lab Science, which certainly could be interpreted as a signal for more extreme attacks, but not in terms of like, I'm going to attack next week using X, Y, or Z. Although, actually, I suppose I should note that they certainly do that with respect to hoaxes. In some cases where they're not actually planning to do an attack, they may say, we're going to do X, purely for the sake of, you know, making people worry that, that this might actually be happening.
And then I'm going to ask two questions. I'm going to ask them at the same time, too, in the interest of time. First is, do we have any information? Do you guys have any insight into just about what proportion of the of this sort of radical movement, the people who might be on the fringe of the fringe, have sort of the education necessary to do these things? And sort of a question sort of riffing off that is, do you get a sense of this movement? I'm assuming you're looking just at the U.S., but do you get the sense that there are other parts of the world where maybe the radical extremist environmentalist movement might be more inclined intent-wise than in the U.S.?
So I'll take a crack at the education question. So in starting this paper, one of the things that we thought was intuitively plausible is that the eco-radical milieu attracted people who on average tended to be better educated and more resourced. It was challenging to track down empirical support for that proposition, which we think is plausible. So we have in the actual paper a little bit of support. So there's a start. The Center for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland has a bunch of databases. And there's a start database of actors across the terrorism space. And so we did some crude comparisons where we looked at actors who were, so this is a coding basically of newspaper articles and other open source information about attacks. So we did a kind of a crude comparison of eco-radical actors as compared to, for example, actors in the domestic U.S. right-wing terrorism milieu. And as you might expect, on average, the eco-radical terrorism-oriented actors are better educated and of a higher higher on the socioeconomic scale. But our empirical support for what we think is a pretty intuitive proposition that eco-radicalism tends to attract some people who are better educated and resourced. You know, we like more robust empirical support for that proposition. The question about the other parts of the world is really interesting, but I think Zach may have some thoughts on that, so I'm going to let him take that.
Yeah, so to address the first part in terms of access to colleges and lab training, so I think Philip captured that generally quite well. So there are a few specific examples that I would also add. So there have been a couple cases where they actually have had lab training. So in the case of RISE, the folks who were undertaking that potential attack, so just as a reminder, those were the folks who attempted to poison the water supply in Chicago in 1972, I believe. One of the folks there was an intern at a hospital, so we had some basic level of lab training. That's how he hoped to get, and not just hope, but did successfully get access to some basic agents that you could potentially use. In terms of the broader space, it's a little bit hard to say. Personally, I think one of the particularly interesting things about this space entirely as it relates to potential insider threats, so people who are actually currently working in a lab would then go into this, is that the ideologies that would actually motivate someone to undertake such an attack may actually cause them to leave that position well prior to actually undertaking the attack. So the Unabomber, for example, he was a math professor at University of Michigan for a while. And well before he actually started sending out bombs, he left his position at the university because he felt that he just couldn't live in this environment anymore and need to get out of, escape sort of the industrial system. So even though some folks may have lab training, it may be hard for them to actually get access to the lab equipment that they would need. Now, in terms of the question about international spread, I think definitely there is some of that. So one of the interesting things about Animal Liberation Front, for example, is that you see postings from all over the world of people undertaking actions in their name. I think recently there was a couple from Italy, I want to say. But basically all over the world, you see some elements of that. And Deep Green Resistance also has, or at least advertises, that they have chapters in 8 or so different countries. I think it's Germany, Italy, France, the UK. They have a general Middle Eastern group, India as well. So there is certainly some international presence for all of these folks. How significant it is, it's not really clear. There have also been a variety of attacks in the UK, a bit more significant. So Animal Rights Militia was largely in the UK.
Excellent. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much. I would encourage our listeners to reach out if you want to see a draft recommendation of their piece. I would highly recommend that. Last thing I will ask you is if you could recommend any further reading, any organizations, anything at all you would recommend if people wanted to know more about this topic. And I just brought up if there are any questions for us at NJOHSP, please feel free to reach out to us as well. So I'll hand it over to you for the final word about what you might be able to recommend.
Sounds great. And thanks very much again for this opportunity, Dean. And thanks to all the folks who tuned in. And I hope I'm not taking too much liberty if I throw in one final substantive thought, which is that I think a further reason to be heartened about these threats is that the groups that select into maximalist objectives tend to be a bit delusional, and so they tend to be self-sabotaging. And that's a dynamic that we saw pretty strikingly with Shinrikyo. That's not to say, though, that someone couldn't either be more capable or get lucky, and even groups who are inept may do things that have serious consequences. Off the top of my head, I don't know that I have specific resources to flag. I suspect that Zach will. And I mean, one of the things we were struck by is that in this narrow space, we thought the literature was quite thin. More broadly, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point you towards our James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, which is one of the global focal points here in Monterey, in DC, and also with an office in Vienna that works broadly on nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons threats with a strong orientation towards state actors, but definitely also touching the non-state piece. And then I teach here in Monterey in a master's program for nonproliferation and terrorism studies. So basically a security studies master's program focused on those two very crucial domains, distinct but with a little bit of overlap, for example, in my cyber and terrorism course. So thanks again, and I'm going to turn it over to Zach for the final word.
Yeah, so I would just add as a couple other resources if folks are interested in radical environmentalism specifically. Don Linick wrote a really excellent book, Eco Warriors, that delves across all of these different currents and delves into a lot of their ideologies. If you're interested in CBRN specifically, Gary Ackerman did an excellent piece back in 2003 that looked narrowly at Earth Liberation Front and looked at their potential for engaging. There's also quite a bit of literature done by these organizations themselves. So Deep Green Resistance actually put out a rather mammoth few hundred pages tome that really gets into the depths of what their ideology is about and what they're trying to do. So I'll just close it off and just say thanks all for joining us today.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.